Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, December 26, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, ho, 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 ho. Hope you had a Merry Christmas. Today is the day after Christmas. Isn't that, is that Boxer Day? Or maybe that was 2 days ago. I don't know. This is Canadian Christmas or something like that, right?
I think you got it right.
And we are on vacation. But we are playing our best ofs, ladies and gentlemen. That's right. Maybe you missed this the first time around. Maybe you didn't. And remember how great this episode was. But we have five of them for you lined up over the next 5 days. And today we have Julie Wilson, author of Neoliberalism, a Textbook. We hear about neoliberalism constantly. People throw it around. I would say 75% of the people who use it on Twitter don't know what the word means. They're close, but it is more often than not, they don't know what they're talking about. After you listen to this episode, you will know. You will be able to use the term neoliberalism with the confidence that you know what you're talking about, not just blathering out of your backside. I have no idea what's going on now. Speaking of as if it was the 26th, because I'm on vacation, and I'm recording this prior to that, so I can't see into the future. Hopefully, Donald Trump is at the very least in Mar-a-Lago, but who knows? I mean, who knows what could happen? Somebody, an errant golf cart, something like that. I mean, I'm not wishing ill.
Or a budget deal.
A budget deal? We don't know. We'll see.
Heard of budget.
Could be. All right. So sit back, enjoy this. And Matt has some best ofs. Now, what is the plan for this best of week? Are you putting? Do you have clips that you're assembling for?
Yeah, some funny clips. So, for instance, there was a Arizona Republican who was called out for, I think, sexual harassment.
And
he circled the camera. So some of these are going to be visual. So there's going to be a little compilation of some of the funniest clips. But that one specifically is probably the most visual. That's going to be on this episode.
Okay, and we're going to keep it open for everybody, right? These are freebie. End of the year freebies.
Yep, Feliz Navidad.
So you get a taste of what the, a slight taste of what the Fun Half is like. And if you want to join us during the year and become a member, go to jointhemajorityreport.com and become a member, support the show. Also, we still have up for our members that debate between Brandon Strachera and myself, where I am, admittedly, the most condescending, glib, and smug.
Aggressive, too.
I don't know. Am I aggressive?
You're insistent that you want to sort of up the ante, I guess.
Yes.
In what he's trying to make you.
Yes. He's trying to get me to admit to something, and I say, oh, not only will I admit to that, I will actually double down on it. In some instances, maybe triple down. So if you're a member, you can check that out, and it's all its glory. You can either do it through Patreon or check it out through our membership at jointhemajorityreport.com. All right, quick break. When we come back, Julie Wilson on her book, Neoliberalism. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Julie Ann Wilson. She's an associate professor at Allegheny College, Department of Communication, Arts and Theater, author of, with Emily Yochim, Mothering Through Precarity, Women's Work in Digital Media, and also of the book Neoliberalism. Julie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So, okay, now we have had many guests over the years to talk about neoliberalism. We hear it in the vernacular used quite a bit. Give us a nutshell definition from your perspective as to what neoliberalism is, and maybe perhaps how it's misused to the extent that it is in, I guess, colloquial usage, particularly online.
Okay, so I really was involved in a lot of debates on the left in terms of to what extent is neoliberalism a useful term. You know, some people will say, why call it neoliberalism? It's just capitalism and liberalism, perhaps on steroids. Why confuse it? But, you know, confuse things by talking about something new. But in the book, I really try to present neoliberalism as a kind of shift in the kind of logics of governance and capitalism that's happened over the course of the 21st century and into the 21st century. But basically the idea is that with liberalism, it was rooted in liberal social thought was rooted in the idea that you have a state and a public sector and a private market. And generally speaking, it was a kind of laissez-faire type thing. The state should stay out of the market as much as possible, but the state was also there to guarantee kind of the rights of individuals, especially property rights. So what happens in neoliberalism, though, is that that you kind of get rid of this line or this idea that there should be a separate public and private, and everything should become marketized. And what that means for people, then, is that they are not citizens with kind of rights and property to protect, but simply capital that should be appreciated. And so in the book, what I'm trying to do is, you know, people talk about neoliberal all the time, in academia especially, but I really was trying to kind of think about the ways that neoliberalism has seeped into our kind of culture and our everyday lives in really powerful ways that make it hard to organize and imagine a kind of world beyond capitalism.
Now,
so, yeah.
And I should just say, for the sake of clarity, when you're saying liberalism, you're talking about classic liberal a thought, right? I mean, we're not talking about the sort of the more colloquial use of a liberal today.
Exactly. So, yes, when I talk about neoliberalism, I'm talking about, and liberalism, we're talking about classical economic free market philosophies, you know, of Adam Smith up through Hayek, who are the neoliberal thinkers. The first thing I tell my students, which is who this book was written for, was that we are so confused about what we think liberal means, and that we have to throw out that kind of colloquial sense that, you know, oh, liberal is the kind of left side of the political spectrum. I said, well, we're all pretty much liberals in some way or another, you know, in the sense that we live in a capitalist free market system.
Right. And my understanding of neoliberalism, as it's traced through sort of Hayek and the Mont Pelerin group, was mm-hmm. this notion that a free market, but we should also we should have enough power within the state to sort of tilt that market in a certain way. Right. I mean, is that how, I mean, give me your sense of that perspective.
Yeah, so I mean, I look at it as neoliberalism actually wants a very aggressive state, but it's not a state that's doing things like taking care of citizens or providing a social safety net. It's a state that's aggressively promoting and protecting private markets and kind of free enterprise, and without a lot of concern for monopolies or kind of power imbalances or anything like that. So, you know, for example, with my students, which kind of, and this goes to the point about the colloquial ways we think about liberal in our political discourse. Like the Affordable Care Act was a very neoliberal policy to the extent that it's the government forcing people into a private healthcare market, right? And so you have a state that is doing things and is not laissez-faire, but is actually mandating people to participate in a kind of private market system of healthcare. And that's just one example of the kind of more left forms of neoliberalism versus the more right forms, which tend to think that the state shouldn't do anything except help rich people get richer.
Right. And so in an example of sort of a conservative form of neoliberalism would be one which a so-called right to work legislation, right?
Or
ones that inhibit the power of labor, let's say, over capital. Promote the power of capital. All right, and I think that's important because there is so much confusion out there about these terms. I'm curious as to just an aside from the moment. How many of your students, like when they come in and they hear these things, like where are they situated when they hear this? Like how much understanding do they have of these terms that I imagine those who are attracted to take your course in the first place have had some interaction with those terms?
Yeah, so the reason I wrote the book and started teaching a class that was dedicated to the concept of neoliberalism was because students would see this word come up in the books that they were reading or the articles that they were reading, and they kept just telling me they just still don't understand it. And the more I would read the literature that came out, just unpacking the history and all of that, I said, yeah, we're going to really dig in. What I found, though, which is so interesting, is that by talking about neoliberalism from a cultural studies perspective like it does, which roots it in people's everyday lives, which are very anxious, people feel very competitive with their peers that they don't necessarily want to feel that way. They have a lot of personal kind of pain, and these are kids that some kids that we might write off as like, oh, you're privileged and you shouldn't worry about that, but in the space of the class it was interesting to see how students could all kind of find their way into this and from a critical perspective, while also not necessarily saying everyone's the same under neoliberalism. We could start to talk about racial injustice and gender injustices and those histories in ways that people didn't get defensive because they were starting to see that neoliberalism was kind of like this, horrible thing that we're all kind of caught up in. And for the most part, I teach a lot of economics students who are majors in economics and then take our more cultural studies classes as their minor. And even those students who tend to be a lot more conservative and pretty much taking neoclassical economics the majority of their career, it really resonates with them. And they kind of, we start talking about debt and what's happened on the financial markets and, how that's connected to mass incarceration and all those kinds of things. And they don't really I guess what I'm trying to say is that students generally don't like the idea of having to think of themselves as human capital.
Right. So. Well, that's very subversive of you. I imagine that's going to get you in trouble at one point, but let's hope not. All right. Well, I want to circle back on that because one of the things I think too from a cultural perspective is just social media and the way that. There's a certain amount of sort of there's been some work on how that is training for the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
In some way. But before we get there, let's talk about the rise of neoliberalism, particularly in this country. And Mont Pelerin, of course, was a European summit, but where did we begin to see that change in the States?
So, I think we trace, and this is really important for, I think, people to understand. It's neoliberalism is kind of born out of, at Mount Pelerin and out of people that are really concerned about the New Deal and what's happening in the wake of the Great Depression. depression with the kind of rise of the social welfare state. But it doesn't really start to make it into kind of mainstream policy until the late 70s, early 80s, you know, with the election of Ronald Reagan for sure. But that's because for years and years, kind of underground, like neoliberal thinkers and organizers were establishing think tanks and producing knowledge that was kind of built on their philosophies of the market. And so then when we have, you know, the oil crises and political crises, you know, people are looking for solutions. What are we going to do? And then here are these think tanks that say, oh, here's a, you know, a radical, wonderful new way to fix the market. And so it was, but it was Reagan, I think. And then I would argue that, you know, Clinton, pretty much all the presidents since Reagan have done a lot to forward a kind of neoliberal hegemony, where in the book, what I want people to understand is that, you know, we have a right spectrum and a left spectrum within our political discourse, but pretty much at this point, both of those, whether you're on the right or left, are kind of contained by neoliberalism. So, and right now, I think that Bernie Sanders' candidacy was probably the, you know, the only kind of mainstream candidate to challenge that. You know, Trump is confused. So,
yes. well, I mean, so, but let's, I mean, from a policy perspective, you know, and you know, aside from sort of, I guess, an economic ideology, like, where did we start to see, did it first emerge as public-private partnerships? Was it more when you see, you know, was Taft Hartley sort of, could that be considered a neoliberal piece of legislation in the sense that it inhibited the union's ability to strike in certain situations? Were there other larger federal policies that, you know, specifically started to track in that direction?
Yeah, so I mean, so to be clear, I'm a cultural studies scholar, but yes, my history on the policies is like the actual dates, but yes, Taft-Hartley, I think Reagan, like going after the labor unions, that was like one of the first big, you know, that was one of the first moves is to break the power of organized labor.
Famously had the air traffic controllers strike, and he essentially broke that.
Yeah, you know, that was Reagan. Yeah, and then, but also the kind of what's happening with the markets and when moving away from the gold standard, the rise of kind of the global financial markets at that kind of level, and then at the level where I think that I spend most of my time thinking about, just in terms of the kind of Clinton's dismantling of welfare and the kind of three strike rules. I mean, this is the state basically saying that if you're going to promote private market competition and the state ceases to really care about its citizens, but to care about kind of global competition in a world market, you know, then you have to kind of have this law, these law and order policies that kind of lock up people, populations, and police populations that are disposable and not necessarily desirable. They're not human capital, right? Those are people that can be relegated to social death. And so, what do you do with them at that point? So, I think Clinton basically creating policies that tell people, you know, they have to go to work, giving tax breaks to companies to engage in these highly exploitative practices, which also of poor people, which also help to break the power of unions as well. Like, I think that's a real crucial moment. And then, of course, you've got, you know, NAFTA and then all the free trade deals and all of that stuff that's happening around the same time as well.
What are the four D's that you talk about in your book?
Well, so I kind of just was trying to, because this book is kind of big picture. I want them to kind of understand like how neoliberalism shapes our kind of social totality, if you will. And the four D's are, I wanted to give students a way to really theorize what are the consequences, the critical consequences of living in a neoliberal world. And so the four D's are meant to kind of capture those. And so the first one being dispossession, right, which is something that David Harvey talks about, accumulation by dispossession. But really what I want people to understand is the way that neoliberalism works to dispossess people, citizens of basic rights, of money, of security, and all of that. And then, but so in a way, what Harvey's talking about is a very kind of economic dispossession that happens with divestment and kind of neoliberal policies. But dispossession can also, we can also think about it as political and cultural processes as well. So I talk about the second D, I think, is disimagination, and that's what happens when we can only think about ourselves as human capital. We kind of find ourselves in a state of what Mark Fisher, the late Mark Fisher, called capitalist realism, right? And we just have to think of ourselves as a brand, and it's about competition and growth. And we kind of lose the ability to think about a kind of broader social world that we live in, you know, we share and live with other beings, human and non-human alike. The third D was, I think, de-democratization, which is something that Wendy Brown talks about in her book on neoliberalism, which I heard her on your show. And that's just the way that neoliberalism, as she says, hollows out kind of politics and democratic process, so that it turns democracy and politics into just a market. And this goes back to your point about social media. What it feels like to be political at this point is pretty much just sharing our opinions and news and talking on social media. And we really, because of neoliberalism, I think, shy away from actually getting involved in the hard work of collective governing, right, and governing our lives together, which is what democracy is rooted in. And then finally, I already mentioned the fourth D is disposability, and the way that neoliberalism has to draw lines between people that are able to appreciate themselves to be productive human capital in a global economy versus those who are disposable and can be relegated to social death and civic death.
Let's talk a little bit about the interplay of these from a cultural standpoint. I mean, you know, social media is the easiest. I would say there's two phenomena that I've noticed, particularly over the past, let's say, 15, 20 years, that culturally, you know, sort of, I guess, implicate particularly the disimagination and the de-democratization, and I guess also the dispossession. I mean, all four of the D's. I mean, and that is, you know, like social media, and then there's sort of like the rise of the how-to books. I mean, it seems to me that when I was younger in the 70s, all of the how-to stuff was about your emotional well-being and finding your inner self. And maybe this is wrong. I have no data to support this, but. But it seems to me,
I think you're onto it. Yeah.
On the past 20 years, all the how-to stuff has been how to make yourself more efficient in achieving some goal that is either marketable or just make you more efficient so that you can compete better. And what are the other sort of phenomena, or the, you know, is that are those reflective of other phenomena that's happening culturally? What are the things that help do that? Or is it simply on some level just there's less money to go around, so everybody's trying to figure out how to make themselves more marketable and do it more efficiently?
I mean, I think it's all of, I mean, I think it's everything that you said. I do think if I was going to hold up what are the two kind of quintessential cultural phenomenon that like help us understand neoliberalism and its kind of cultural power, and I would say the rise of self-help. And then also more recently, kind of social media. But I think what you're getting at with the kind of self-actualization movement of the 70s was a really, and then the transformation of self-help into these more like how to brand yourself, how to, you know, be more efficient, all those kinds of things. But there, you know, neoliberalism pulled off this really neat trick, where it kind of tapped into the counterculture, and as well as the civil rights movements of the 60s and 70s too, that were all critical of the welfare state and the way that it kind of squashed individualism in particular. And so in order to kind of be liberated, right, you needed to kind of really get in touch with yourself and not this kind of bureaucratic, oppressive state. And then, but what that does is it basically turns that, which all those movements, and there are some good things about that you know, that historical moment. But it really taps into that, but then basically puts it in the service of, you know, neoliberalism, creating a world where people have to take personal responsibility for your life. So there's no more safety nets. People have to kind of do everything on their own. They are supposed to live their lives as in competition with their fellow citizens and whatnot. And so how do you do that? That produces a lot of anxiety, a lot of insecurity. Well, then you have self-help kind of stepping in, and instead of being a force for like personal liberation and like, you know, like you said, maybe getting in touch with yourself, like those kinds of things, it becomes a kind of way to control and govern the population as kind of, you know, they have to be these disconnected, alienated individuals solely focused on their own appreciation in the market.
It's interesting. I mean, that dynamic of in the late 60s and maybe the mid 60s and certainly I think in the 70s that ran sort of, I guess, concurrent with the civil rights movement, but was, you know, one part of the counterculture, you know, the turn on, tune in and drop out. I guess it was Timothy Leary, but that attitude of like sort of create your own reality and putting the individual outside of the collective. I mean, I guess that's part of that phenomena, right? Like where the idea was drop out of the conformity, but it turned into reject collectivism.
Right. Exactly. And I don't think that it necessarily, you know, there was, I mean, you know, history is totally contingent. I don't think things necessarily kind of had to go that way. But I think that because there was that kind of sensibility within the counterculture that was very strong and very seductive in a lot of ways that you could understand, and then to have the rise of neoliberalism kind of riding, you know, on the backs of those moments and these kind of cultural phenomenon. And you have, you know, marketers, you know, this is also around the time of the rise of lifestyle marketing and new psychographics and all that kind of stuff. So there's just like a whole convergence of forces, I think, at work.
So there. you have these competing philosophies as there is a broad feeling of, you know, of individualism and one is getting heavily financed too at that time, right? I mean, this is the early 70s is where you start to see a lot of money, you know, I guess, you know, sort of following the Powell memo, you started to see a lot of very wealthy people pouring money into groups like the Heritage Foundation and
exactly.
others that are sort of pushing these agendas. And now you also talk about the hustle, self-enterprise and the neoliberal labor. This is, I guess, sort of a more of this, you know, 4-hour work week type of stuff.
Yeah. So basically the way the book is kind of mapped out is the first half is supposed to give you kind of a broad sense of the history and what is neoliberalism and like, what are the kind of big consequences? We talked about the 4 D's and then I use the education system to kind of help people see how this all plays out. But then the second part, I really want people to see and understand the kind of way that neoliberalism kind of encompasses all dimensions of our life. So the chapter on called The Hustle is about labor and how our working lives, you know, we all have to work, we all have to figure out a way to get by. How does neoliberalism and this kind of idea that we have to be self-branding and personally responsible and appreciating our human capital all the time, how does that kind of, you know, play out in our working lives? And really what I want to do in that chapter is to help students and readers draw lines of connection between the kind of way that they feel that they have to kind of, you know, be constantly doing different gigs or kind of hustling or working 24/7 or working on social media to brand themselves so they can network on LinkedIn or whatnot, to, that's like, there, people are kind of forced to hustle. They're disciplined and they have to hustle that way to kind of get by. There's this fear of failure, of slipping. But there are also ways that the state, it's not, you feel like a free agent, but the state is also forcing people to hustle too, whether it's through the kind of shifts in welfare, which force people into really crappy jobs, or whether it's the way that we have rethought, you know, for example, how we finance higher education, so that, you know, young people who are in my classes have all this debt, and that means that they're going to have to take certain jobs instead of others, or think about their lives in particular ways. And also thinking about the hustle in terms of gender and the way that we still, even though things have changed a lot, we still have this idea that, you know, for the most part, women are naturalized caretakers, and the family has to be this place, you know, this kind of landing pad in this cruel world of neoliberalism, and the mothers are really hustling, and women are really hustling, you know, when you don't have a strong public school system, when both parents are working all the time. So I was really, in that chapter, really trying to think about, okay, what happens to work in neoliberalism, and what are the connections between all these folks that might feel really divided along perhaps racial, gender lines, but we're all hustling. That was the kind of
The student debt thing, I mean, it seems to me is a great example of how the state contributes to this. I mean, the idea, I mean, aside from the shift over the years from providing a very low cost public option in most states across the country, or many states, I should say, you know, through the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, versus now student debt being virtually the only debt, as far as I know, that is not dischargeable in a bankruptcy is pretty stunning. I mean,
yeah,
it doesn't matter how rock bottom you get, you're going to always owe that money for educating yourself. It really does for a, you know, irrational for you to follow a career trajectory that is not going to allow you to pay off that debt.
Right.
I mean, if you have that option, which isn't necessarily there, and it's pretty stunning. And from an educational standpoint, and maybe how else is it primarily through higher education, or do we see this in other aspects in terms of the state in education? Are charters a part of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think neoliberalism thinks that, I mean, and the neoliberal thinkers think that you're going to get a good and just society, and like a kind of true entrepreneurial society by privatizing and marketizing everything. So that means schools too. So public education is, you know, the idea that the state or collectively in communities or however you want to think about it, that this is something that we do together, like education, and we provide resources, and we, you know, the idea is that, like, let's create a competition among schools, and that will, you know, provide a better education, and the cream of the crop will rise to the top through that kind of system, as opposed to, again, a bureaucratic kind of top-down public education system. So yeah, I think, you know, and again, we're fighting battles over this, how do we preserve public education? Healthcare is another example too of the way that the state is kind of involved in perpetuating neoliberalism in certain ways. But I think, again, that we're also still, you know, especially in the realm of education, I think more and more people are growing, it's not acceptable to have this kind of standard-driven, benchmark, test-heavy system. We see more and more resistance there. And I think that that's a potentially kind of galvanizing issue. But again, the hard part is that, you know, well, if you don't want your students in that public education system, then you put them in a charter or a private school, and then you're still contributing to neoliberalism in certain ways. So it's a really tricky, thorny issue. But
and talk about you have a chapter, the moods of enterprise, neoliberal affect, and the care of self. Is that more of the way that we imagine ourselves in the context of, what makes for the better self in this type of era?
Yeah, I was trying to think about what we talked a little bit about earlier, the rise of self-help, but how in a neoliberal world where you're human capital are you supposed to care for and kind of cultivate the self? And I want to address head on because so many of my students, struggle with mental health issues of anxiety, depression, and there's a lot of great research out there on the connection, and more and more is growing, and the connection between the rise of neoliberalism and the rise of widespread anxiety and depression. So I wanted to kind of confront that and then think about what are the two kind of, I guess you could say, trends within self-help, or what are the kind of ways we could think about what's going on there. And one of those is about the kind of financialization of the self that Randy Martin talked about in his book, The Financialization of Daily Life. And that's, again, how does that change the way we move through the world and the way we relate to other people and think about our bodies and think about our possibilities for being with other people or for social life when we have to think about ourselves in terms of finance, right? So I kind of try to give some examples about how that plays out through apps and wellness apps and whatnot. And then the other one is a term
I just
from,
say that, I mean, it's
oh, yeah.
because my daughter is, insisted on getting Sweatcoin, which like pays her some type of like faux cryptocurrency for exercise. Basically coupons she can buy, I think clothing with or something. That is, it seems to me, sort of the perfect example of we're you know, you're going to be a literally a you're going to generate a cryptocurrency if you're healthy, I guess, is the message there.
Exactly. I mean, that's perfect.
It's everything super disturbing.
Marketable. It's horrible.
I want to talk about the neoliberal citizenship and the privatization of politics too, before we talk about how you hope your students will react to this. I mean, because and I guess this gets to disimagination, but before we get there, I mean, tell us about the privatization of politics and the what it means to be a neoliberal citizen.
Yeah, so I think in that chapter, and we've already touched on a lot of this, but just the way that that neoliberalism kind of hollows out democracy. And I really like the way Wendy Brown talks about a kind of bare democracy, this idea that we can govern ourselves collectively together. That's the promise of democracy. And what happens within neoliberalism is kind of politics is totally privatized. So you get the important political actors are philanthropists and donors, and you as an individual kind of, donor perhaps, or a consumer, if you think about things like product red or green, buying green products, all that kind of stuff. So I think it's just the way that politics doesn't become about democracy anymore. It becomes about kind of expressing oneself through the market, right? And we see that both in terms of consumption and consumer culture and, celebrities endorsing causes, all that. And then we also see it, I think, too, as I mentioned earlier, on social media, where politics is about kind of getting yourself out there in an economy of visibility or you're participating in this kind of circulation of content, which is constantly being capitalized and monetized and then fed back to you, So it's completely privatized. It's not about collective governance in any sense. It's about a kind of self-expression of your political beliefs in a kind of market that you are not actually, you might engage in conversation, but it's completely disconnected from that hard work of governing, a kind of population or a community, or thinking about how are we going to kind of get things done together on the ground. And so that's kind of what that chapter is about.
Before we get to that question about the students, I mean, I'm struck by, there's been a decent amount of reporting as of late, particularly in the wake of Donald Trump's victory, about the activization, if that's a word, activation of suburban educated, somewhat older women who are at least engaging in organizing for electoral politics. You know, we the recently coming out of like, you know, and I've mentioned this report a couple of times, but Theta Scopel and Lena Putnam reporting from like research from Georgia and from Virginia and Pennsylvania, I should say. And I mean, what do you make of that? Because this is a group who I would imagine, like, are these a group of people who are not necessarily imagining themselves, you know, have not been raised in formative years with this like sort of intense idea of marketing themselves in the way that, let's say, my 12-year-old daughter certainly is, and maybe even a 27 or 30-year-old is. I mean, is there what's going on there from your perspective, or is that, I mean, from a cultural standpoint?
So, I mean, you know, it's hard to say, you know, what's going on with specific people and communities, but I can talk about where I am, and I see a lot of connection. So it's funny when I'm writing the book, because a big part of it is that, like, I want people to see that, like, neoliberalism is not working, right? And people are really disaffected from it. They're, you know, like I said, my students are sitting there, even though they've been pumped with this ideology their whole life, but they're like, oh, my God, you know, this is not the world that I want to live in, and thank you for helping me understand why I feel so terrible about my existence and how I can start to, you know, think differently. I think that everywhere, people are sensing the cracks and the fact that this is not a kind of way to take care of each other. I think most people, I'm one of those people that believes that, like, human beings, you know, tend to be actually really concerned about, you know, their neighbors and want to take care of people. And, you know, neoliberalism has told this story that we all have to be competing and fearful of each other. But, you know, I do think that there's something that people are starting to see, like, this is not okay. And as neoliberalism continues to kind of destabilize and rip apart the very foundations that make for community or make for social life or make for the possibility of being with other people who we need, I think you're going to see people start to step up in lots of different ways. So you'll see people running for office, right, and getting involved in electoral politics, or you'll see that's happening in our community in northwestern Pennsylvania, but you've also see people organizing for new economic systems and basically saying Wall Street and like global economics, they don't care about this place. So how can we create a new economic system that's going to really take care of people? How can we kind of collectivize ownership of buildings that have been forgotten or in disrepair because, you know, the jobs left and divestment and all of that. So I think that that we're in this moment potentially of transition where there's a lot of organizing happening at a lot of different layers. It's not the state is, you know, the neoliberal state is incredibly powerful and strong, and you see that in the use of executive orders by presidents and all that. Like, again, it's hard to think about democracy in that formal way seems hollowed out, but then when you're in communities and you're looking at what people are doing and how activated they are, it does. You know, I'm not sure where it's all leading and where it's all going to go, but I do think that the resistance is growing, but we need to be able to draw lines of connection between whether you're working, you know, in the Black Lives Matter movement, or whether you're working in the labor movement, or whether you're working, you're a group of women, you know, working in electoral politics, or you're working on kind of solar issues in a community or food. You know, we need to be able to see those as connected, which is kind of why I wrote the book, because unless we have a kind of common horizon that's not neoliberal, I don't know how we're going to kind of get out of this place.
All right. So let me just talk about the kids, because I wonder, and I should say students, because I have a hard time sort of imagining, you know, on some level, like what I would do if I was someone that age today. How do I, as an individual, you know, create a situation where being a citizen, being a member of the community, being involved in multiple communities has that is not organized by, you know, likes and assessment. I have a tough time imagining that for them. And frankly, you know, I sit here and on a daily basis, the number of hits on YouTube or the downloads that I get or, are relevant to my well-being and my kids' well-being on some level.
Yeah.
I mean, so once they've read this, once they have sort of said, oh, wow, yeah, this, I recognize this in my life, and it is a bit of a drag, like, what's the next step?
So we talk about this a lot. In the book, I try to prompt them to think about little ways that you can, and just in the course of your everyday life, that you can start to kind of resist the stranglehold that neoliberalism has on your imagination. And that could be in the realm of friendships. I'm a media scholar, so I'm kind of wary when people say, oh, the problem's all media, just get off social media. But thinking about what are your friendships like, and we read stuff and think about what might make for more deep friendships where you would start to trust other people again. Because, you know, I feel very far away from my students when I talk to them about their relationships, whether they're romantic relationships or friend relationships. There's no sense of trust, and there's a lot of fear. And a lot of my best students, you know, that are really critical and want to change the world, they're incredibly alienated from each other, right? So in these very little ways, how do you start to forge relationships of trust and whatnot? My college, I'm in the communication arts department. I also teach in community justice studies. We do a lot of community-based research and a lot of community-engaged work. And so getting students into the place in really meaningful ways where they're interacting with folks that are different from them, and kind of seeing the process by which, like, how is the city going to kind of deal with the opioid crisis right now? Or, there's a huge amount of community organizing going on. And in one of my classes right now, we're having our students interview those people and create podcasts about the work that's happening in Meadville. And that stuff is incredibly transformative. And then thinking about leaving college, I mean, they wrestle with the problem. Like, I'm going to have all this debt. I want to resist and, you know, whatever, but I can't do that. It's going to ruin my credit score. And we just talk a lot about, like, it's not a, you know, you're never going to be free from it. You know, I'm a professor and, like, I have to worry about the same things you do about how many books am I, you know, like, and I, social media, that, I mean, we live in this world. But in other ways, too, I get to kind of be part of things that are happening here, part of the education and helping us think, you know, how can we kind of push beyond it? But I do think a student emailed me just 2 days ago and said, you know, Julie, like, she graduated a couple years ago. She's like, I didn't understand what you kept saying about you just got to get involved in kind of your place and your community and, like, the kind of local, again, that kind of feeling for democracy and working with people that you might not like that are different from you. She's like, I did that. Instead of being on social media, posting my kind of feminist post and I'm so mad at the world, I got involved with my local library, and it's been hard and frustrating, and it's so much better than, like, spending my time on social media, right? But I think, you know, there, again, it goes back to there's just lots of layers of organizing that I think we all have to, you know, Naomi Klein said in her book, This Changes Everything, it's all hands on deck. So I try not to say, oh, this is the right way to do it, or this is where you should be, but it's a kind of like, we've got to kind of everyone do what they can do from where they are.
And lastly, what do you think that fear and lack of trust, where does that come from? I mean, what is it? Is it a function of the, is that a function of the fact that as opposed to when I grew up, I had far more ability to regulate what parts of me I would share with friends and what they could do with that. I mean, it just seems to me that, like, as I look at, you know, youth today, they can't escape their past because it will live online forever. Mm-hmm. They can't regulate really in any meaningful way what they share with people through the means in which everybody shares stuff now, right? I mean, you could say I'm only going to okay certain friends, but the stuff is digital. I mean, is that what makes everyone somewhat, I guess, you know, distrustful or guarded, or what is that?
I think that social media kind of epitomizes and is kind of like a neoliberal machine. But I think it's even more fundamental than that. So if you are kind of growing up in a world where every day and everywhere you look and when you're in school, you're kind of interpolated or hailed as capital, as human capital, as this thing that has to constantly be growing, right, then the possibility of failure is everywhere and terrifying. And
everybody's competition.
Exactly. Everyone is competition. So you can't trust them. You can't take those risks. And you have to be constantly focused on yourself. But I think that what that does, what social media brings to that, and that's a terrible way to move through the world, right? In terms of when you're thinking about organizing. But what social media does to that is I think create really kind of narcissistic subjects. And I don't mean narcissistic in the sense that they love themselves. I mean that it's so fragile because you can always get, if you're online, you can always be looking for that confirmation of growth, right? Or confirmation of your capital or appreciate. I got this many likes. I texted this person that I like and they texted me right back. So it's this constant... you're kind of conditioned by the technology to kind of crave and look for that constant self-appreciation, right? Or that constant growth or that constant validation. And so it just kind of takes the inherent anxiety of neoliberalism and this idea of human capital and, like, you know, technologizes it or operationalizes it in a way so that, you know, people are just so constant in need of reinforcement and validation, but you know, the kind of, I guess in psychology they talk about a self-concept is really fragile, and that's what narcissism is, where you just need other people to constantly confirm who you are, right? Because your own self is so fragile. And that's what I see happening a lot. And I think my students recognize it, which is a lot of them good, but then like you said, it's like our worlds are so mediated, at least, you know, here, that it's hard. It's even if you see it happening, it's still hard to like not participate in it, right?
Julie Wilson, the book is Neoliberalism. It's available through Routledge Press. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll, of course, put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
All right. Well, at least this dude...
This is feel good.
At least this is a little bit feel good. This is Representative Don Shooter. Not kidding. Not kidding. He is a Arizona state lawmaker from Yuma, Arizona. He's a Republican, 65 years old. He has been accused of sexual harassment by, what are we up to now? 8 women?
I think I saw 9.
9 women. The last of which I think was in November. We have the classic contemporaneous talking about the harassment, et cetera, et cetera. And this guy is really opening himself up. There's nothing like a guy who's willing to at least address these accusations. Remember, this is someone being paid by the taxpayers, and here he is. He's being asked about these accusations by a reporter from Arizona's family, is that what it is? It's a political editor. Dennis Welch asked him just this Friday about the ongoing sexual harassment investigation in which he's involved.
Representative Shooter,
get out of here.
We want to ask you to respond to all the women that have made accusations.
There is an ongoing investigation. Mm-hmm. Can't comment.
Well, you've got to comment about the women, what the women are saying about you.
No, Dennis, I don't have to. There's an ongoing investigation.
Okay, do you think this is a distraction from the legislative session?
There's
starting?
An ongoing investigation. I will have no comment. There's an ongoing investigation. I will have no comment. Do you? Any confusion?
No, there's no
At
confusion.
At a certain point, you are the one that's harassing people.
Pause it now. Now, the representative, Don Shooter, does not seem to understand what sexual harassment is about. But, of course, as a Republican, he naturally adopts the conservative aggrievement pose. It's all about how I'm getting harassed just because I harassed, in quotes, nine, in quotes, women.
Two rights don't make a wrong.
Ten wrongs don't make a right. Now, we could just leave it there. And he says, look, please, I'd like to sit and eat lunch. I know you want a quote from me, but I'm not going to give you one because I don't feel it's my responsibility to even pretend that this exists. But that's not what Representative Don Shooter does.
No, there's no
At a certain point, you are the one that's harassing people.
I'm not harassing
you. You are harassing me. I feel harassed.
This is a public
event, harassed.
Sir.
Yeah, well, I feel harassed in public.
But you're Pause not it.
So, and here he is also now taking the opportunity to say, like, oh, I'm just doing the same thing that all these women do. I feel harassed. You say I'm not harassing. You're not harassing me. But the definition of harassment is if I feel harassed. But that's not where it ends.
So you should be answering these kinds of questions. You've been accused of some serious...
Nice.
What are you doing?
What are you doing?
Why'd you do that?
Seemed like the right thing to do.
Wait for it. Wait for it. This is the best part. It's coming. And nice little sip of ice water.
Oh my God. So if you're just listening to the show, go to YouTube and watch our clip of this. He at one point decides that the right thing to do was to... All right, well, here, you know, let's play it again. Here he goes. So the reporter asks him, like, look, you got to talk about this. And Shooter sort of walks off, and then he realizes, like, he's still on camera. And so he walks up into the face of the camera, and as the camera tries to turn around from away from him, he keeps following the camera with his face right in the camera and does a full 360. It's like a do-si-do. Go ahead.
Questions. You've been accused of some serious...
There he goes. He walks up into the camera, into the face of the camera, into the face of the camera, staring at the camera. And the reporter's just like, what are you doing? Like he does actually a 720.
What are you doing?
What are you doing?
Why'd you do that?
Seemed like the right thing to do.
He's so confident. Seemed like the right thing to do. He just went over and just wet my whistle here. Little sip of water because I feel like I might be having a heart attack.
This is what happens when you elect dumb jocks to office. Like, seriously, he reminds me of the kid from American Vandal in this clip.
He's totally trying to intimidate
Felt them. Like the right thing to do.
Like, you're a harasser.
You're harassing. Gets used to harass you now. It's you.
There was a quality where he felt like I think what he wanted to do was get into a physical confrontation with the cameraman. And then he realized, like, I can't do it. Yeah. And so he's holding himself back as he spins around. Like, it's just like, I'm going to count to 10.
What
nine,
kind of existential
eight.
Moment is that for him? Just looking into the dark lens, realizing, like, he's like, really humiliated himself.
Never going federal. I'm never going statewide. The girl at the Arby's wasn't even that hot anyways.
That cameraman went to the same school as that guy that kept the camera on Trump after Dickerson asked him about Obama being like worse than Watergate, and Trump went back to his desk and like just shuffled the papers.
Papers. Lots of work. Paperwork. Things to read.
I have moved on with my life. This is what I've been doing.
Totally over this interaction. Means nothing to me. Definitely not having an impact on my emotions.
Jordan Peterson, has now found his way to Fox and Friends. He's arrived. This is the, you know, and this is the professor, the Canadian psychology professor, who has risen to the top of the alt-light heap by basically, this is the new, and you know, we mentioned this a while back, and it took a little bit longer than I thought, but when Republicans have control of our government, we end up seeing stuff like culture war stuff rise in prominence on the right. And years ago, it was the war on Christmas. And now, according to Jordan Peterson, it's the war on men or the war on traditional gender, I guess, you know, gender assessment, whatever it is. But I'm telling you, whatever it is that they're worried about, it is happening, according to them. And it's all over, and it's going to sweep us all up. You sit there on your couch, Fox and Friends, and I sit here in my studio, and we're just minding our own business, but it's beating down the door, just like the Muslims, the gays used to do, and then somehow they're not as much of an issue anymore.
Not top priority in the same way.
They used to be. They used to be. Or the secularists. They used to be. They used to be coming for you. And the bra burners. They would burn your bra right off of your chest back in the day.
Now,
of course, it's those trans people. They're coming for you.
Now let's talk about something else that builds on your premise. This whole father-daughter dance that are being canceled around the country because of gender guidelines. Even Donald Trump Jr. weighed in with this quote. The father-daughter dances inherently leave people out, not just because of transgender status, just life in general. These can be really uncomfortable, triggering events. That, according to Jared Fox, New York City Department of Education.
All right, pause it for 1 second. Now clearly, Dum Dum got his teleprompter mixed up. Donald Trump Jr. did not say these leave people out and whatnot. Also, I would be willing to bet that if there were 100 father-daughter dances scheduled for this year in this country, or let's say 1,000, to the extent that any have been canceled, I would probably put that number around 1 or 2. This is exactly the same dynamic as the war on Christmas. There is a place in Wisconsin where they changed, you know, Silent Night to First Night, and the Christmas is not going to exist within 16 months.
It reminds me of what Donald Trump Jr. said about Chappelle's new specials, where he said, problematic can illustrate and elucidate bigotry, but all too often I feel as if Chappelle's using comedic license. It was interesting.
Yeah.
John Jr. has some really interesting woke Twitter
takes. All right, so go back a little bit, and so this clearly this quote was not from Don Jr., but go ahead.
Even Donald Trump Jr. weighed in with this quote. The father-daughter dances inherently leave people out, not just because of transgender status, just life in general. These can be really uncomfortable, triggering events. That, according to Jared Fox, New York City Department of Education.
What?
So that's their response to cancel the dance because there's a lot of people that can't go. Mm-hmm. Is there a problem with that?
Well, the problem with that is self-evident, but it's part of this absolute onslaught by the radical leftists on the fundamental normative structures of our culture.
Pause it 1 second. All right. Now, the good doctor says that the problems with this are self-evident. Now, I live in New York. I have a daughter. It is not totally clear to me what the problem is that some dance that I've never heard of has been called off because people can't. Or maybe for all we know, maybe they just aren't even calling a father-daughter. Maybe they're just calling it parent-kid.
That's not as special as father-daughter. And maybe you're a cuck, frankly, and you're like, I don't want to do my daddy-daughter dance because it will hurt my rotator cuffs.
You had to explain that to me, so it's clearly not self-evident. Continue.
Boom.
...of our culture. And if you're going to cancel everything that's triggering to everyone, then you're going to cancel everything altogether. Because there isn't a single thing that anyone can ever say or do that isn't going to offend
someone. Everything's
going to
be canceled.
And the idea that this is being done so that certain people's feelings won't be hurt, I think, is absolutely absurd. It's not compassion and care that's driving this. It's the desire to put forward a very pernicious ideology, and it's being very, very successful in its application.
But Dr. Peterson, they say that they're doing that to make things more inclusive.
Yeah, well, they say all sorts of things, and they are a very small, noisy, dangerous minority.
Pause it. First of all, I can tell you it is true. They say all sorts of things. That, I think, is self-evident. And these danger, I mean, what do we even know what they're talking about? Like, what dance was canceled, or was it just changed to parents' kids?
I mean, these things have a way of changing as they go down the line until there's basically no truth left. If anyone knows, feel free to tell us.
It was changed to you can only dance with your kid if you're a tranny because they want everyone else not to dance anymore. It's absurd.
You know, the one thing is true is, like, you know what you never hear about anymore? Sock hops. You never hear about anybody going to the sock hop anymore.
What the hell?
See? You see? That's how pernicious this is. Back in the 50s, everybody would go to a sock hop. But now, there's no sock hops. Ipso facto, the professor is correcto. Good.
All sorts of things, and they are a very small, noisy, dangerous minority.
Dangerous.
And it's really appalling that we're bending over backwards to do their bidding
without
question.
None of us were planning to go.
Under the name of compassion.
A lot of my friends have been posting pictures of the daddy-daughter dance recently, and I think the pictures are so cute. Are little girls going to miss out on a memory?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, for sure.
For sure.
The thing is that even your terminology, when you're talking about little girls,
is
something that's going to be increasingly forbidden as we demolish the classic gender ideas. And no one's going to benefit from that.
And people
it's going to be a real catastrophe.
I mean, people are even talking about deciding on what gender they want to be as youngsters.
Yeah, well, that's happening all over. It's an absolute epidemic. And we've decided that children...
You ready for the absolute epidemic that he's talking about? It's an absolute epidemic.
Good. We have
that's happening all over. It's an absolute epidemic, and we've decided that children as young as 3 or 4 can now decide what gender they are and then undergo the appropriate surgical and biological alterations to bring their morphology in keeping with that. And it's a mistake of epic proportions, and we're going to pay for it in a
Only
big way.
Chicks we do with cakes can dance with their children. It's an epidemic.
We have decided that children as young as 3 and 4 can begin to have gender reassignment surgery.
Oh, we need to fact check this guy now? Okay.
Well, I hate to do this. I hate to do this because I know, you know, people's own life experience. You know, people see the gender reassignment surgery with 3 and 4 year olds all the time. But
can I have a non-funny fact check?
Well, let me do this. Check. The World Professional Association for Transgender's Health say that one, genital surgery should not be carried out until patients reach the legal age of majority in a given country, and that two, patients have lived continuously for at least 12 months in the gender role. So that's 18 in most of the states in this country. There are puberty blockers, which, to the extent that they're used in this country, the average age is around 12 and a half years old. All that does is it slows down or it prevents someone from hitting puberty so that they have the option of having less development if they decide. There's hormone therapy that on average happens at age 16 and a half. For kids ages 3 or 4 who feel that they are ID or their gender is different than what it was given at birth, they do stuff like dressing like the other gender or styling with their other gender, or living in congruence with the other gender in some fashion or another. But, of course, it's epidemic proportions.
It's just seaweed. I can't call my TA a fine piece of ass anymore. My language is restricted.
You know what is an epidemic? Suicide among transgender youth. So,
well,
sorry if I don't find his
price. Price must be paid. Price must be paid to maintain the
tribute,
normative.
Like Shylock in Merchant
like
of Venice.
Like, he's such a bozo.
It's archetypal thinking.
But then I think about that, and it's not even funny anymore.
Right.
It sucks.
Well, that's what this guy's going out there to defend.
You know why you don't think it's funny? That proves my other point, which is that men and women can't work together anymore.
Yes. In fact, let's tune in to Jordan Peterson, who just the other day said he wasn't sure that they can be in the same workplace.
Here's a question. Can men and women work together in the workplace?
Yes,
How do you do it. How do you know?
Because I work with a lot of women.
Right. Well, it's been happening for, what, 40 years? And things are deteriorating very rapidly at the moment in terms of the relationships between men and women.
Is there sexual harassment in the workplace? Yes. Should it stop? That'd be good. Will it? Well, not at the moment it won't, because we don't know what the rules are.
Do you think men and women can work in the workplace together?
I don't know.
Without sexual harassment?
We'll see.
Well, how many years will it take for men and women working in the workplace together?
More than 40.
To get a sense.
We don't know what the rules are. Like, what? Here's a rule.
How about
no makeup in the workplace?
Why would that be a rule?
Why should you wear makeup in the workplace? Isn't that sexually provocative?
No. What?
It's not?
No.
Well, what is it then? What's the purpose of makeup?
Some people would like to just put on makeup.
Why?
I don't know why.
Why do you make your lips red?
Look good.
Because they turn red during sexual arousal. That's why. Why do you put rouge on your cheeks? Same reason.
Pause it for one second. Why is this guy grease his hair like that? Because maybe you sweat during sex? Why is this guy put on that, wear that outfit? Why is he wearing that sport coat?
It might take only 15 years for Asians because you have less kiloliters of testosterone.
So how about this? Only black lipstick in workplace.
There can be black
I'm
lipstick
down with that.
And Chinese and Chinamen can work in groups of women.
How about high heels?
What about high heels?
What about them? They're there to exaggerate sexual attractiveness. That's what high heels do. Now, I'm not saying that people shouldn't use sexual displays in the workplace. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that that is what they're doing. And that is what they're doing.
Do you feel like a serious woman who does not want sexual harassment in the workplace, do you feel like if she wears makeup in the workplace that she is somewhat being critical?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do think that.
There you go. You know, I'm sorry, but I think we can put the countdown clock on this guy.
Excuse me, if you'll excuse me.
There's going to be an unwinding, and it's not going to be pretty.
If you'll
That's
excuse
what I
me,
be.
I need to go masturbate now. This conversation's been extremely stimulating. And by the way, while we're at it, I think Jerry Sandusky was innocent.
Well,
clear Jerry Sandusky's name.
He doesn't say that Jerry Sandusky was innocent.
No,
he
I do
simply
not.
Thinks that there are some legitimate questions out there.
There's a lot of
kids
questions.
Were asking for it.
It's not that they were asking for it. That's a misrepresentation.
I notice a lot of those kids have very flushed lips.
You know,
why would they do that?
I just realized. It's
why
a bit...
would that child be in Umbro shorts?
He's like Dr. Evil's like.
I know.
It's like
a very
professor
Dr. Evil
cousin.
Impression.
It's,
a very...
it's unbelievable.
He did evil. I did psychology. And the whole thing is absurd.
I like how nonplussed the guy is who's talking to him, too. He's like, what?
Did a good job there.
Yeah. Area code, who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. This is Canada's premier polymath, Jordan Peterson.
Hello, Jordan.
I've taken a break from masturbating in the bathroom at work to address some criticisms I've received on this program as of late.
Okay.
Bad voice,
First off,
good content.
You asked me why is my hair so greasy? Pomade and other hair products that result in a conspicuously slick sheen are reminders of a previous hierarchy in which men's hair could look like an orb and women could be groped in a hallway for dressing like whores. And again, I come back to makeup in the workplace. Why do women make their lips red? Why do they put rouge on their cheeks? Why do they wear high heels? To exaggerate sexual attractiveness to their bosses. Pigs! Pigs! Why do pigs have these cute little upturned noses? And why do they have those cute little curly-cute tails above their pink, pert pig buttocks? Why Why is it okay to openly talk about eating pig butt as a cut of meat, yet if I were to tell my TA that I want to eat her big pig butt at work, she's black, by the way, that's a problem. That's a problem. It's a problem with
not that that should matter.
And don't get me started on the absurdity of outlawing daddy-daughter dances. The daddy-daughter dances and memories that I have would have been erased from my memory in some kind of Sam Harris computer fantasy. In this legislation where it's passed, it's just absurd. And you ask me, why am I jerking off right now? Why am I jerking off right now? Why?
Why?
To exaggerate my sexual attractiveness. Ritual bestiality with swine was common in previous hierarchies and social structures. They are very smart, very loving, very generous loving animals.
Thank you for the...
And you stop laughing. Clean your room, Michael. I'm your father. I'm your father. Who's your daddy, you fucking cultural Marxist?
Okay. You got it.
Oh, that was a killer.
There you go.
I always hoped that he would call into the show.
Yep.
If that was actually Jordan Peterson, I'd have him on my show like once a month.
That was pretty good.